We'll hear argument next in the case of United States against Turner. Mr. Lanto.
Good morning. I'm Reno C. Lanto, Jr. from Rantoul, Illinois, on behalf of the appellant, James Turner. James Turner began the sentencing process in this case with a loss total on count 7, the only count of conviction, of $397,000, which, all other things remaining equal in this particular case, would have translated into basically a final form guideline sentence of 5 to 6 years at level 26. By the time he ended the sentencing process, he had been pegged with all $13.9 million of the loss that transpired over the roughly 6 years of the whole conspiracy, which raised him to a level 34, 12 and a half to 15 years, a vast difference between the count of conviction and the final relevant conduct finding in this particular case. So there were a number of errors in the sentencing process. But basically, we're looking at two errors of law, and I think grievous errors in findings of fact, unreliable findings of fact.
You refer to findings of fact. Where are the district court's findings of fact?
Well, I perhaps elevated this more than I should have, because the only finding of fact that I was going to deal with was the final pre-sentence report finding. With reference
where
to
are the district court's findings? Our circuit rule requires lawyers to append to their briefs the district court's rulings that are under review. The district court gave reasons for imposing the sentence. They're not in your appendix. You put in the appendix your objections to the PSR and then omitted the district court's rulings. And then you certified to this court under Circuit Rule 30 that you had included in the appendix everything that is required to be included, a certification that is transparently false.
Well, Your Honor, I apologize then for that, because I thought
we don't accept apologies here. Sanctions are what follow from this kind of thing. Where can we find the district court's findings?
Your Honor, it's referred to in my brief with regard to the pre-sentence report and the sentencing transcript, in which we objected to the finding the full $13.9 million of the loss being attributed to Mr. Turner. The court in that particular pre-sentence hearing adopted the findings of the final pre-sentence report that basically give us almost no findings of fact with regard to the $13.9 million and his participation back to 94. The count of conviction, Your Honor,
the district court ultimately found, which we tracked down, no thanks to you, the district court ultimately found that your client joined this conspiracy in 1994. In other words, that he was in from the beginning. The whole premise of your brief is that he joined some years later. You never mentioned that finding of fact by the district court, let alone append it to your brief.
Well, that was my neglect then, Judge, and I can only say that I thought I had appended everything that was necessary. But
there is no ambiguity in our rule, and there is no thing appended to your brief that is remotely related to the district court's findings. You append your objections.
But we do refer to the pre-sentence hearing and the judge's findings in the pre-sentence hearing, Judge. Or in the sentence hearing. And that, to my mistake, is what I thought would suffice for a finding of the judge's factual finding in this matter. The judge initially stated as a matter of law that regardless of when Turner joined the conspiracy, that he was responsible for all the conspiracy from 1994 through 2000 as a matter of law. And my premise is that that ignores...
That was the first day of the sentencing hearing. And then at the second day, the judge changed his tune.
That's correct.
In a finding that, as I say, you have completely omitted not only from your appendix, but there is no reference whatsoever to it in your brief.
The second day, the judge found in the sentencing transcript, judge, a second ground for his finding that Turner was responsible for the whole 6 years and the losses of the whole 6 years, in that the jury found Turner guilty of count 7, along with 16 other people, and since that count said the conspiracy lasted from 94 to 2000, ergo, the jury found him guilty of a conspiracy being part of the conspiracy lasting that long. That, again, is an error of law, Judge. It neglects the fact that, A, there is no reason for the jury to decide that particular issue. Relevant conduct is a matter solely for the court. There is no practical mechanism for the jury to decide that particular issue. Again, it's a matter for the court. The court was wrong with that particular finding. The court then basically adopted the finding of the pre-sentence report with regard to this supposed loan down in North Carolina that the co-conspirator, Franklin Myers, had at some point made a proffer or some statement that the pre-sentence of the probation office picked up, that some loans were made by Hood, some of which were Omega money, in 1994. The final analysis of that particular factual issue that was that the probation office posited after objections was that then Myers said that, or Hood said that he had made loans to 40 or 50 people, and that Hood had at times had Mr. Turner go out and try and collect these things. Relevant conduct, as the court is aware, has to be criminal conduct. Relevant conduct that's over and above the basic loss level of the count of conviction must, under this court's Schaefer decision, specifically articulate the facts on which it rests. There simply is no fact whatsoever from that particular finding by the probation office from which one could find that Mr. Turner went down to North Carolina to collect any of these so-called debts. When he went down to collect these so-called debts, if he ever did, whether or not at the time he did so, he was aware these were Omega funds and was aware of the nature of those funds, and whether, if he did, he did anything to conceal those funds. I would submit, Your Honor, that basically we're dealing with a situation in which there is no evidence of record whatsoever, reliable, upon which the court could make that finding that Turner was, in 1994, a part of this conspiracy. Whatever came is insufficient, but it's also insufficient, not reliable under the Schaefer and Palmer cases that this court has posited, because it came from a non-testifying co-conspirator. There simply is not a basis for fact or law for holding Mr. Turner to full $13.9 million in a drastically...
Who is the non-testifying co-conspirator?
Pardon me?
Who is the non-testifying co-conspirator?
Franklin Myers. Franklin Myers did testify at our trial. He did not, in any way, shape, or manner, touch upon this particular fact, anything whatsoever about Hood helping collect any loans in 1994 or doing anything before 97 or 98.
Did he provide non-testimonial affidavits or other information?
That, too, is somewhat unclear. The prosecution identified, or I guess the probation office initially identified this language is coming from a, quote, proffer of Franklin Myers, who did plead guilty at some time, I believe in 2001. The judge and the prosecution also recalled on the record in our transcript that Myers had testified to this in one of the trials. Looking at the transcript in Myers' testimony, certainly wasn't this trial, and Myers did not come back to testify in the sentencing hearing. Briefly, the other thing I'd like to address is the question of some of IRS agent Hinesley's opinions in this particular case. Hinesley initially was qualified in a pretrial hearing as a 1006 witness to take the Turner's bank account records and do a summary of those account records. One of the things she did at that point in time in the pre-sentence hearing, or the pretrial hearing, was to formulate a summary, called a cash summary, of cash deposits to the Turner's bank accounts over roughly a five-year period. Defense objected to that because Hinesley herself admitted that she could not tie any of the Omega funds, and she had spent years at this, could not tie any of the Omega funds to those particular cash deposits to the Turner's accounts. Therefore, we objected it was irrelevant. And in the context of this particular case, when we've got some $19 million in total fraud losses, most of which came pouring in $20 to $50 cash deposits, it obviously is prejudicial to our client. It should not have been allowed. It was not relevant. It was prejudicial. The second thing with regard to Agent Hinesley that we were concerned with and are concerned with here is that she was instantaneously, in the midst of her testimony, after only being qualified as a 1006 summary witness, into what amounts to a 702 expert witness without the Daubert or the, in this court's opinion, in Brumley, scrutiny from the court as the gatekeeper. Suddenly, she began giving opinions that what Turner was doing was, quote, money laundering and obstruction, unquote. We did object to that particular statement and was sustained, but she then went on to testify, not in a hypothetical, but directly, with regard to Mr. Turner's actions as to what his intent or purpose was in the transaction on the Marshall property. And she said it was structuring, keeping deposits under $10,000 to prevent the bank from filing a CTR. We objected to that. The court at that point said, basically, she's an IRS agent. I think she's eminently qualified to testify to that. That was the sum total of the Daubert and Brumley gatekeeping function. She then went on, numerous occasions as set forth in my brief, to simply give her opinion that what they were doing was money laundering. That all these people, the transactions, Hood, Turner, and the rest of them, were money laundering in a conspiracy. That simply amounts to a violation of 703B, giving an opinion as to the mental state, purpose, or intent when that is a material element. It definitely was here. I have nothing further. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Lanza. Mr. Sanchez.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Esteban Sanchez and I represent the United States in this cause. Now, James Turner was the money launderer's best friend in this case. He did whatever was asked of him efficiently and without any hesitation. He transported thousands of dollars across state lines at a moment's notice. He agreed to title property purchased with the proceeds of the Omega fraud in his name and that of his sister. He structured financial transactions.
When was the first one of those transactions?
That he titled property in his name, I believe sometime in late 1995, 1996.
What shows that he joined the conspiracy in 94, the year of its inception? Because it looks like the sentence turns on that finding.
Yes, it does.
And the district judge didn't explain the basis for his findings. So in your view, what is its basis?
In my view, Your Honor, the basis are the cumulative evidence that was presented at trial. At trial, the evidence was very clear from both sides, both from testimony from Mr. Hood and other people from the prosecution side and from Mr. Turner on the defense side, that Mr. Turner and Mr. Hood have been best friends since the middle 1980s.
Yeah, but and you don't necessarily join conspiracies with your best friend. The critical question, let's assume that the evidence shows that he went in 1994 to go collect a debt.
Yes, sir.
Which we know in retrospect was from Omega Fund.
Yes, sir.
What is it that shows that he was doing this as an effort to collect criminal proceeds as opposed to a favor for a friend without knowledge of the source of the proceeds?
Well,
those are the two competing possibilities.
Yes. The evidence during the trial, and it has to be put in perspective, was that these people were close friends. That they were not, hear me out, Your Honor, I understand your question. That they were intimately related, that they were associates in many other ventures throughout the 80s and early 90s.
So there's an assumption they each knew what the other was up to.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the assumption you're
following. And in fact,
including criminal intent.
Yes. And in fact, Clyde Hood discussed with...
Other than that modest leap forward, friends always exchange confidential information. What concrete information was there?
Well, Clyde Hood testified at trial that beginning in 1994 when his financial fortune turns, and Turner clearly seen this, that about Omega, they discuss Omega, they discuss...
Who's they?
Turner and Hood. Hood tells, because Turner is asking, where are you getting your money? How come you're doing so well? Hood says to Turner, well, it's Omega, and they continue to discuss it throughout. Testimony from Hood was that Turner was aware that he was parceling out this money to friends and relatives for these loans.
The testimony shows that these discussions came in 1994.
It started in 1994 and transgressed through 1996 and, of course, throughout 2000.
Where in the record do you want us to look to see that these discussions occurred in 1994?
During Mr. Hood's testimony, Your Honor.
Page 7 on your brief might lead you there with this background.
Thank you, Your Honor. That I was looking. On the transcript, pages 306 to 307, in 344 to 358, there's some discussion about that. On the trip to Texas to purchase this old refinery that they were intending to scrap, they discussed Omega. So the court had sufficient evidence, background evidence on the trial to suggest, to believe that Mr. Turner was aware and Mr. Turner had joined the conspiracy in 1994. In addition to that,
your own brief says by 1996 Turner was a frequent visitor.
Yes.
There's nothing really trying to pin down the early date when Turner would have known that this was a criminal organization.
Well, the only thing, or the evidence that would suggest that is the evidence of Turner's and Hood's constant discussion about finances and about their about Hood's involvement in this thing called Omega. And the evidence could testify that he told Turner that Omega was some sort of investment that he was running. And he would not
say it was a sham investment, it was a crooked enterprise, it was just an investment program he had set up?
He did not say that it was a scam. He did not tell Turner that it was a scam.
He said it was an investment program that he had created.
An investment program, yes. Your Honor, which I think is where Judge McCuskey can put, having heard the evidence and having seen the witness, can put things in perspective.
Yeah, well, he has to take something that the witness said, other than the way he looked, to determine what got the defendant Turner in.
Well, the fact that Mr. Hood was a retired electrician from Mattoon that had never been involved in any sort of investment program, the fact that Mr. Hood was not a sophisticated multinational investment broker, the fact that Mr. Hood was basically a person who had retired and was basically doing odd jobs, struggling financially after having lost a job at a local factory as a factory electrician, all this money.
I admit it raised a small question on mine, but you know, people do funny things like this all the time. People that are otherwise apparently untalented suddenly make an awful lot of money with creating investments. So what would trigger Turner's knowledge of that? Did he know he was a crook? Had he ever done anything wrong before? Had he ever been convicted of a crime? Did he know that he was immersed in nefarious activities?
Hood had been convicted of a crime and had been under investigation.
Turner.
I assume that, I can only assume that he did because of the close association with each other.
Is there anything on the record other than your assumption that indicates that Turner was aware of the criminal record? What was the criminal record for, by the way?
There was an arson involving the burning of a garage. There were some issues regarding to another oil investment type program that...
This was well known in the community at large and everybody knew it, but...
I cannot say that, Your Honor.
But there's nothing in the record to show Turner was aware of those issues.
There was nothing in the record to show, on the trial record, to show that, Turner knew this in 1994.
Well, beyond the trial, any part of the record of this proceeding before us that shows that Turner was aware of the criminal background and the criminal activities going on with the operation that Hood explained to him. By the way, somebody named Hood strikes me as being, that should raise your suspicion immediately, anybody named Hood that's involved in criminal activities.
Well, we thought so.
Well, in your brief, you indicate that, again, at page 7, that he, meaning Hood, also told Turner that he was using investors' money to support himself, to make his purchases, and to loan money to friends and relatives.
That's correct. He did tell him that. Now, Judge Bauer, as to date and time when that occurred, I can't...
Well, assuming you knew that in 1994, that he had an investment fund, and that the investment fund gave him access to money so that he could loan it to friends and relatives and support himself, sounds like a bank, doesn't it?
I'm sorry, I do not understand.
I said it sounds like a bank. Isn't that what banks do? They take money and they support themselves, the bankers support money, and they loan money, sometimes to friends and relatives.
The difference is that in the banks, the people who deposit the money in the bank know what the money's going to be used for.
I know, but there's...
In this instance...
I want to know, where does the show Turner knew that wasn't going?
Well...
Did he cross-examine them? Yes. How did you do this? Why do you do this?
Turner denied any knowledge of the Omega until he was arrested in cross-examination. But to answer your first question is... The first question as to why is this different than a bank?
Well, I know why it's different than a bank. Well, I don't know how Turner would think it's different than a bank.
Well, Turner would think it's different because he knows that if it's an investment program where Hood is taking money from other people to invest for them, but he's using them to loan people to people in North Carolina or to friends and relatives.
Well, that could be part of the investment, couldn't it?
No, because if the investment was for...
does the investment involve giving money to somebody else to make more money?
That could be. That's what, like you referenced with banks does. But the difference here is what was the Hood's intent with this investment fraud. But I think, Your Honor, that it all boils down to whether the district court clearly erred, when it found that all of these factors put together and then corroborated by this proffer of evidence that was given by Mr. Myers, or Reverend Myers, he was a reverend, at the time, that...
You know, Barnum was very, very modest in his appraisal of the saps that are in the world. He said there's a sucker born every minute. As near as I can tell, reading his record, he underestimated by, you know, several hundred rods.
Counsel, when we get back to the 64, is it only by inference that he joined a conspiracy in 94, I mean? By inference that he joined a conspiracy in 94?
No, he helped Hood. He drove him around. He drove him to Texas. He went to...
But did he know it was a criminal enterprise that he was involved in?
Yes. In my opinion, yes, because Mr. Hood told him, what I'm doing... I'm taking these people's money and I'm using it for other things. And therefore, it wouldn't take a leap to, even for Mr. Turner, to say something is not right here.
Give me a small rundown, if you've answered Judge Candy's question, about the expertise of the lady IRS agent.
In that instance, Your Honor, toward the end of the direct examination of Ms. Hinesley, she was asked to provide a name. She had described a transaction where, yes. And she was asked to say, what is that called? That was objected to, and she wasn't allowed to answer the question. At the time, the judge indicated that she was, as an IRS agent, was able to form an opinion or to tell what the name of those transactions are called. After that, the direct examination ceased, and after that, Mr. Turner's counsel proceeded to cross-examine Ms. Hinesley. And it is at that time that he pointedly asked questions about whether it was her opinion that what Turner had done was intended to conceal, or whether what Turner had done...
So all of that came out on cross-examination?
Initially on cross-examination. Then on redirect examination, there were four other questions.
The door was opened in the first instance by direct cross-examination.
That's correct. Judge Kenny, did I respond to your question?
Yes. Okay. I mean, that. I guess you responded as well as you can, because there's no testimony that on January 1st, 1994, Turner was told that running a scam.
Right.
Everything has to be drawn from inference.
From inference and from what happened during that period of time. Who were these people in this transaction? And certainly, the fact that he joined... The fact that he increased his participation as time went on, as he started to get more...
Well, it doesn't appear to be any question from the record that by 96 he was well aware of what was going on.
He was deep in it, yes. For the reason that... Let me address the issue of Reverend Myers, if I may, just for 1 second. Reverend Myers proffered pursuant to a cooperation agreement, and this is the basis for which the judge supported its findings, its conclusion that based upon this other evidence, this is consistent with what Turner had done closer to the time of the arrest. He collected money. That was one of his roles in the conspiracy. He did it with Martin Rose. He did it with Natalie Richardson. So it was appropriate and not clearer for the court to consider Reverend Myers, having heard him testify not only during his Rule 11 change of plea hearing, in which there was an extensive colloquy where Myers explained what he had done as part of the conspiracy, but also during the trial in this cause, For the reasons I stated and for the other matters that have been raised in the appellant's brief, I stand on our brief, and I ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Lantau?
I simply would refer the court with regard to all these citations that Mr. Sanchez refers to showing the conspiracy going back to 94, pages 10 and 11 and part of 12 of my reply brief. I tried to deal with each one of those by going back to those specific citations and checking them and coming up with the conclusions that I did. Just one other thing with regard to the factual findings of the judge in the sentencing process. He made those on the face of the final pre-sentence report. It occurred to me that that pre-sentence report should have been part of the record in this case, but I perhaps mistakenly read the rules of this court to specifically prohibit appending the pre-sentence report. And that may have been, probably was my error. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.